And we finally did do a tour. I don't know, a year or so later, we actually did a real tour of the West Coast. We were playing up and down, and we did a show in Portland. And afterward, a fan came up to us with a cassette tape. He said, "You guys are about to hear this. You're going to love this. What is it? Just listen to it." Took it back to the hotel room. We put it on, and there's a recording of a, at the time, very popular top 40 DJ by the name of Casey Kasem. Now, how many of you here know who Casey Kasem is? Okay, a lot, but not everybody, because it's actually, I'm realizing there's a generational thing, because he's actually kind of dropped out of the picture, and now he's in his 70s, I think. Casey Kasem is like a nationally popular DJ, would do dedications. He's also on the air on Top 40 Radio. He's also the voice of Scooby-Doo. Ruby, Ruby, Roo! That's Casey. Interestingly enough, Casey is also one of the only people in the entertainment industry who spoke out against the first invasion of Iraq. He's an animal rights activist. He has been arrested for civil disobedience for protesting nuclear testing. He's a kind of interesting guy. But Casey Kasem, on this particular day that he was recorded, was having a very hard time in the studio and was being a complete, horrible, monstrous asshole to the engineer and saying all kinds of incredible, amazing things when he was trying to do his different voiceovers. And when you do voice recordings, you know, you usually do a lot of takes over and over again so you can kind of get the right one for the editor to pick from. Does this make sense? So probably the engineer's revenge for being treated so badly was to get these tapes out. And nowadays, if these tapes leaked out of someone popular, like, for instance, how many of you have seen the video of Britney Spears, obviously high on something that's not marijuana, on YouTube? Anybody? It's great! Oh, my God. It's her husband filming her, and they're eating pizza, and Britney Spears is acting. She's clenching her jaws and starting to talk about space and time and going backwards in time. And she's on either, you know, LSD, ecstasy, cocaine. I mean, there's no way she's just stoned, which, of course, they've kind of claimed. And it's totally creepy and completely weird. And as soon as this got out, of course, it's everywhere, except for you people. But I saw it. I like to keep up with what's up with old Britney. Well, anyway, what was my point? My point was is that if a tape like this surfaced of Casey Kasem nowadays, or someone, you know, the equivalent in our celebrity-obsessed culture, it would be everywhere. It would be, you know, and everyone would have heard it. And in fact, we would not be inspired to make something out of it at all. I mean, I think Negative Land's always been excited by things we find that we think no one else has. And most of our work, if you do ever hear it, and from what I'm showing you tonight, most of it's pretty obscure stuff. That's kind of what we're drawn to. We're not so much drawn to really recognizable things, with a few kind of spectacular examples where we did use recognizable things and things happened. So he's trying to do a dedication of a song by a band. He gets the country wrong that the band is from, but it's a band that you may have heard of called U2. You've heard of that. You haven't seen the Britney Spears high on ecstasy video, but you know who, U2 is. Anyway, so he was talking about U2, and we were thinking, wow, maybe we could have Casey kind of introducing an actual U2 song, but kind of have it then disintegrate and devolve into something else when he starts to go berserk in the studio. And then I kind of was envisioning having David in our group, David Wills, who has a very strange voice, kind of talks like this and has a rather unusual perspective on the world. And I thought if we gave him Bono's lyrics to one of their songs, he'd probably mess them up in an interesting way. We started thinking about the U2 spy plane, which is where U2 stole their name from. This is a spy plane that was famously shot down in 1960 over the Soviet Union. We were spying on them and claiming we were not. That's actually an event that changed world history very dramatically. The Cold War ramped way, way up when it was actually winding down, because it was the first time I'm aware of a president being very publicly caught in a lie. Eisenhower said it was a weather plane gun, of course, and then it turned out the Soviets had captured the pilot alive. Anyway, we thought about using that spy plane image, and we're thinking about this is a spy plane going places it's not supposed to go, looking for things. I still haven't found what I'm looking for. That song seemed to fit. We found this karaoke kind of version where you could put the musical note data into your computer, kind of a sequence for the music, but you could then arrange it with your own sounds, I guess, to sing along to or something. We found that. And we had tape recordings we had been collecting for years of these really great, super jerky asshole trucker guys trying to find someone and track him down to beat the hell out of him because he's making fun of them. And so they're looking for things. We had recordings of people talking about trying to find obscenities in music, and just so many great ideas. We actually ended up turned into just two tracks, a single with an A-side and a B-side. We put all the worst, foulest language on the B-side, and we decided to call the B-side Special Edit Radio Mix. And that's for all you DJs out there, that we thought maybe a station would get it and just go, oh, that's the DJ version, I'll put it on the air. And so in the very end, when we were coming up with this project, which just all the ideas were so irresistibly fun and good, and we were just totally inspired. And I was thinking, I mean, it's like, what's an example? I mean, ideas are like, they're like some beautiful person who walks into the room. I mean, they're you can't ignore them. If this idea comes, they come from who knows where. And just to say, oh, I can't do that because I don't know, we could get in trouble. That to me just seems crazy, insane, it's ridiculous. You know, you've got to do those ideas because who knows if you have another one. Well, The last thing that we ended up doing, which was kind of our undoing, was we thought we were going to call the record U-2, but then at the last minute the designer said, well, you know, the plane could be the dash, and we could make Negative Land really tiny and the U-2 really, really big. And it would look like it was a new record by U-2 called Negative Land. Now, I think you all have to admit, this is a good idea, right? not like that it couldn't get you in trouble, but it's a good idea, right? It is. This is a great idea. The idea that people could go into record stores and be confused and not know what this was, you know, and try to figure it out. You know, we were envisioning these thousands of incredible moments that would happen in record stores all over the U.S. of people who worked at the stores. Everyone was like, what? But we also thought, because I do like to kind of treat people like maybe people are stupid and we're all thieves and we're all liars, but I like to go through life treating people like they are smart and honorable and ethical and figure things out. And because I think maybe people will, you know, they're only going to, you know, rise to the level of what you expect. And if you expect the worst, maybe that's what you get. So we thought people would figure this out. We were shocked to find out things happened, like Tower Records put up an entire giant display for this record in the front window of their store, you know, in Dallas, thinking this was the new U2 record before anyone heard it. Well, within 10 days of this record coming out, we were hit with a 200-page lawsuit from U2's record label, Island Records, and their publisher, Polygram Music. And we were sued for, of course, copyright infringement, also trademark infringement for using the U2 on the cover, defamation of character for associating foul language with the clean-cut image of the band U2. failure to obtain, well, if you do a cover version of a song, you don't have to get permission. You're supposed to pay a fee every time you sell it or perform it, but you don't ask to get permission. But if you change the lyrics, you're supposed to get permission. So they sued us for that, and of course they sued us for fraud, saying this was a get-rich-quick scheme intended to dupe millions of innocent U2 fans and make us a lot of money. And the lawyer they hired, we found out, was a guy named Charles Ordner, Madonna's lawyer. So it was pretty intense. And before I go any further, I guess I should just show you a film that we made to go along with the B-side of the single. And this is the one thing I'm going to show you tonight that is an honest-to-God real piece of illegal art. There is a court order against Negative Land, and I have all, you know, I can show it to you. It says we're not supposed to play it, perform it, talk about it, do anything with it whatsoever. And so, don't tell anybody.
Oops. Now, we're up to our long-distance dedication. And this one is about kids and pets and a situation that we can all understand, whether we have kids or pets or neither. It's from a man in Cincinnati, Ohio, and here's what he writes. Dear Casey, this may seem to be a strange dedication request, but I'm quite sincere, and it'll mean a lot if you play it. Recently, there was a death in our family. He was a little dog named Snuggles, but he was most certainly a part of... Let's come start again. From coming out of the record. Play the record, okay? Please.
Casey, you should play that arm on me.
That's the letter U and the numeral 2. The four-man band features Adam Clayton on bass, Larry Mullen on drums, Dave Evans, nicknamed The Edge, on... This is bullshit. Nobody cares. These guys are from England, and who gives a shit?
Oh, yeah.
Just a lot of wasted names that don't mean diddly shit.
For sure. You don't know where you're at. Don't know shit about you.
This is bullshit.
Sounds like it's portable, too.
Who gives a shit? Diddly shit. Nobody cares.
It's getting stronger all the time here.
Snuggles.
Yeah.
Snuggles.
Oh, yeah.
Snuggles.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
He was a little dog named Snuggles. This is American Top 40. This is American Top 40. This is bullshit.
This is bullshit.
Transitions, and then you got to go into somebody dying. God damn it, if we can't come out of a slow record, I don't understand it. Why are we doing these instrumentals? Because we got them? I don't understand it.
This is also nothing new.
I don't understand it.
This is also nothing new.
I don't understand it.
I think that people read more into the music than is really there.
Well, if somebody find out the goddamn answer in the 50s,
they considered it vulgar and despicable to have songs like Teach Me Tonight, Let You Feel My Cold Water, all of you like cold water. Those were considered euphemisms for something dirty.
Who gives a shit?
Some vulgar, dirty act.
Diddly shit.
The Kingston Trio sang a song that used the word damn, was banned on the radio.
God damn it.
In the 60s, it was a song called Louie Louie.
God damn it.
Upside back.
God damn it.
Every way they could play it, looking for the dirty message.
God damn it.
Never found the dirty message. The FCC was brought in.
Oh, fuck.
In the 70s, people went through the same experience, looking for the dirty message of the song. I think don't think that the satanic message is there. Goddamn concerted effort to come out of a record that isn't a fucking up-tempo record every time I do a goddamn death dedication. It's a last goddamn time I want somebody to use his fucking brain to not come out of a goddamn record that is that's up-tempo, and I gotta talk about a fucking dog dying.
I gotta get some fucking with so much shit.
Silver shit hair again.
Who knows? You might be destroying this kid's town.
What is this fucking ponderous, man? Ponderous. Fucking ponderous. This is American Top 40, right here on the radio station you grew up with, Music Radio 138. Oh, fuck.
Oh, fuck you, Liz.
Well, fuck you too, Richard.
Oh,
fuck you, Liz. Fuck you too, Richard.
Sorry about the shit. Well, he said it enough times, we just thought, what the heck, we'll show some. It's actually mine.
Thanks for sharing.
Just wanted to share that with you. Let's see, where are we? Well, obviously we were being sued for one particular piece of work, but at this point we had been doing this kind of appropriation and collage for 11 years, and we were really being sued for what we did and who we were. And having gone through this experience with the Axberger hoax had taught us a lot about how to deal with the media. And we realized, well, one, being sued, if any of you have been through it, it is horrifying, debilitating, awful experience. You know, it's like having a flesh-eating zombie that's attached to your gnawing away at your neck for years and years and years. It's very painful. But at the same time, we were being sued on behalf of the world's largest rock band at that time, a liberal do-gooder band, of all things, you know, the good guys. And we thought that we maybe, what we'd been handed was not a problem, but an incredible opportunity, and that because of U2's popularity, we had a chance to address the larger issues about corporate ownership of our culture and what does it mean to make art and be creative in this, you know, world we live in, and actually get it into the mainstream news, because the mainstream news would like the soap opera juicy, you know, aspect of you know, oh, big band U2, you know, takes big shit on little band Negative Land. And of course, the other thing is that we were never sued by U2. We were sued by their record label and their publisher, but the media, which likes to simplify things, never got that story straight. You know, almost never. It's almost always just played out as U2 crushes Negative Land. And so it caused us as a group to really, I mean, we don't talk about our work like I am to you now to each other. We work very intuitively and we just do what we do. And so it really forced us to kind of really have to talk about it and look at it and think about, like, do we really want to risk losing everything? Do we really believe in what we're doing and this whole practice of making music and art? Is it worth fighting for and losing all of our recordings and all of our money and absolutely everything because they're wrong and we're right? We're like, hell yes, we're going to fight them. And we kind of just thought, we have the power in a way, because we have nothing. We really didn't have much to lose in a way when you really added it all up. We ended up losing about $45,000, which is a lot. I live below poverty level income, so it's a lot of money. But we put out a press release that we were able to kind of really clearly talk about this idea that something wrong is going on when corporations are claiming to privatize absolutely everything in the world and all we're supposed to do is passively consume it. And when you think about intellectual property law, it's not just about art and culture. If any of you know what's happened with patenting seeds, with Monsanto, with farmers in you know, India who have to pay money to now use seeds, heirloom seeds they've been using for 3,000 years. You know, it's a kind of insanity that's going on. So we kind of thought there's a lot of things going on with corporate power that's really horrible and abusive, but the way we were experiencing it as, you know, privileged white middle class guys, you know, the hammer came down on us because we made this silly record. And we could actually talk about, you know, there's something larger going on here that really needs to be addressed. And in 91, no one was talking about this from a progressive standpoint. All we were hearing from in the media was about, you were hearing from music industry attorneys and lawyers and managers and very conservative points of view. So it was kind of like, and nowadays you have things like Creative Commons, I'm sure many of you know of. They're like the Sierra Club of intellectual property. You know, hi, I'm from Earth First, but I'm glad the Sierra Club is there. But we actually worked with Creative Commons to create their sampling license. If you ever go on to their site and see that one, that's something we actually worked with them. And we don't entirely agree with Creative Commons and all their approach, but I think we were enough on the same side that we thought we wouldn't hold our noses and be purists and not work with them when they came to us and wanted our help. But anyway, these issues now become incredibly mainstream. I mean, a lot of people know what fair use... How many of you all know what fair use means? See? It's amazing. Well, we We ended up deciding to document the whole insane story in a book, which actually has all the press releases, faxes, phone calls, lawsuits, and everything, which we called Fair Use, the story of the letter U and the numeral 2. Back then, we thought, people don't really know this term, fair use. And fair use, if you don't know what it is, it's the notion in copyright law that there are instances where it's okay to use a bit of someone else's work without permission. That's why if someone writes a review of a book, they can excerpt from it, and they don't have to get permission to do that. I think that's a great idea. So Negative Land just wants to see that concept applied to everything, you know, and particularly to art, whether art has, it could be pure nonsense. Most of our work tends to have a little bit more of a political critique in it, but, you know, any kind of art ought to be able to do that. Art ought to be able to take from other art, too. There's no reason that, you know, if a Pepsi billboard isn't off limits to me, why is another a chunk of someone else's art, music, painting, or whatever, why would that be off limits to me? That just strikes me as common sense that if we're using anything less than the whole and you're appropriating it and transforming it, transformative reuse is a term the Supreme Court has used. I think that's great. So anyway, we really we published this book because we thought the story needed to be told, and the story, in fact, is both. The book is about what it's about, because it tells the story in narrative fashion, but by using all the actual things that happen. We don't actually retell it to you. You get to sort of follow all the different sides of the story yourself. So it also, I think, treats the audience with a lot more respect as well. A lot of crazy things happened, like an overzealous fan of ours tracked down Casey Kasem's home phone number and left him threatening messages trying to get Casey to try to help us get our record back. Casey contacted the FBI. And we had the experience of being investigated by the FBI for real. And the conversation, I couldn't say it was a phone call or could have possibly been recorded, because you're not allowed to do that unless they know you're recording them. But I have a very good memory, and I was able to write down the entire conversation with the FBI verbatim because of my photographic memory. That's what the lawyers told me to say. We also tricked The Edge into an interview. He didn't know who we were, and we were friends with a guy who was an editor of a magazine who was going to interview them, and he let us handle it. And all kinds of interesting things happened. And that kept us sane, too, because as the story dragged on and on and on, knowing we were going to ultimately turn it all into a book, you know, definitely gave us that kind of, you know, inner strength to keep fighting the good fight. So there's, of course, I could go on and on about the story, but it it's why I'm here, you know, and as I've said before, you know, we've never had a hit single, but we have had a hit lawsuit. So we have some very strange notoriety from this. But because at the time no one was talking about all this, it really felt like kind of God had handed us our mission. You know, Negative Land, you were wrong. Christianity is not stupid. You have to go out and tell the world about copyright law and why it's being abused. And so that's what we did. That's what we did. And never set out to be... I don't want to become a lobbyist. I don't want to move to Washington, D.C. and fight these fights. But there we were. You know, this is our work. And the other reason to fight this fight with these guys was that, just for ourselves, I thought if we can completely and totally humiliate and embarrass these people who went after us, we can basically put the whole music industry on notice to at least leave us alone. And that has been true. We have not been sued since then. Many people think otherwise, but we have not. And I've met plenty of people in the mainstream music industry, you know, and they'll say, oh, we know who you guys are, and no, we don't. We know you don't make any money from what you do, A, and also, B, if we went after you, you'd just probably make it into an art project, and we don't really want to help you do that. So we've had, anyway, lots more interesting adventures because of this.